Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Greetings. You're listening to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. We're glad you've joined us today. I'm Buck Habrichter, a faculty member here at the War College and one of the editors at the War Room. Today, we bring you the second of three episodes on the role of economics in grand strategy. Dr. Richard New, formerly a senior economist with RAND, and Dr. Joel Hillison, a U.S. Army War College faculty member in the Department of Distance Education, are back in the studio to continue this exploration. On today's episode, they're exploring another of the pillars in the 2017 National Security Strategy, the idea of preserving peace through strength, which focuses on renewing America's competitive advantages in the global arena.
Hello, I'm Joel Hillison, Professor of National Security Studies at the U.S. Army War College, and I'm joined again by Dr. Richard New, formerly Senior Economist at RAND Corporation. Thank you again for joining me, Dr. New.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So at the War College, we study theorists like Little Hart, and he was this famous 20th century British military theorist, and he argued that the role of grand strategy was to coordinate and direct all the resources of a nation or band of nations towards the attainment of a political object. A more recent scholar, John Lewis Gaddis, a Cold War historian, describes grand strategy as the alignment of potentially unlimited aspirations with necessarily limited demand. It's a very economic way of looking at the world. And because resources are scarce, states should look for areas where they have a competitive advantage over other states. So my question to you, Dr. New, is, does the United States have a competitive advantage with regards to economics?
Yes. Let's start with the obvious. I mean, we are a richly endowed country with enormous resources, fertile land, all those sorts of things. That God gave us those. Some things we've also made ourselves. We've, over the history of the United States, made a highly educated and motivated workforce. U.S. workers are the very best, with the output per worker in the U.S. is among big nations. I mean, you can find little countries sort of like Switzerland that do better than we do, but all the big countries, the United States workers are more productive than anybody else. Partly that's because they're good workers.
Right.
But that's also partly because the other thing we've built for ourselves is a very strong industrial base. These workers have lots of good machines to work with that make them productive. This is all our legacy that we've built. But even more important than that, I think, is that we continue to add to that legacy. And there's a certain irony in this. I was listening to your introduction, and you were talking about these grand strategists talking about how governments should try to align everything to support a grand strategy. In a funny sort of way, the real beauty of the United States and the real strength of the United States for a century has been that the government doesn't try to direct the economy.
Keeps its hands off and let the economy, the market work.
Exactly. Now, it's not obvious from first principles that will be the successful strategy, but all of history says, yes, it is. Now, we've had moments in history when we have honestly doubted that. You may remember that back in the 1950s, Khrushchev said, we will bury you.
Right.
And when he said it, that wasn't absurd. The Soviet Union was growing faster than the United States. And, well, we all know what happened there.
Right.
And then later, this so-called mixed model of government and industry in Japan looked like it was taking over the world. And you may remember these scary books like Japan as number one. Well, that didn't work out either, because Japan just was not flexible enough to move with rapidly changing times. And today, the counterexample or the competing model is Chinese, where the government has a very heavy hand. And China is doing very well right at the moment, but its growth is slowing, and it's not at all clear that China will be able to make the transition from depending mostly on exports to depending mostly on its own internal demand. So the real competitive strength of the United States, I think, is in our system.
Okay. And you mean political and economic
system. Yes, but particularly the interaction between the two.
Okay.
That the politics generally keeps their hands off.
Right.
Now, if you're wanting to be pessimistic, you might ask whether we can sustain that. I think every generation has to revisit that. And making the case for leaving the economy to do its thing, even if it has to go through some bad patches
right.
from time to time, that takes courage. And I think every generation has to discover whether we still have the confidence and the courage to leave it alone.
Right. Yeah, and that's there's always competing demands from your constituents, you know, if you're in a political office of trying to meet current demands versus future requirements. I did want to talk a little bit about the economic tools that the United States has, and you already mentioned some of these more centrally planned authoritarian governments. They can easily pick favorite industries and funnel resources to them and move more quickly in certain areas because they can direct state and private resources, because many of them are state-owned enterprises, in China's example at least. But we do still have some tools where the United States government gets involved, and things like monetary and fiscal policy. I'd be interested in your thoughts on what the role is of monetary and fiscal policy with regards to the United States.
Mm-hmm. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that the utility of these tools, monetary policy and fiscal policy in broad terms, are necessarily limited. They are valuable tools to help us stabilize the economy. When we hit a rough patch, either because oil prices have shot up, that happened in the 70s, or because something goes wrong with the financial system, that's what happened in 2007.
Right.
Sometimes the economy needs help getting back on its feet. And monetary policy, basically that means cutting interest rates to encourage companies to invest and encourage households to borrow and buy cars and appliances and all those sorts of things to help getting the economy going again. And fiscal policy, which means if we're seeing a temporary weakness in private demand, the government can buy goods and services to get the economy growing again. These can be very valuable tools to smooth out rough patches, but they really cannot in themselves generate long-term growth. And in fact, the most damaging things that I think we have to worry about sometimes is that we misuse these tools and use them excessively and then create inflation or financial bubbles or something like that. They're great, but they have to be
when used appropriately.
Temporary.
Yes,
they have, and that means temporary. So, and smoothing out the ups and the downs of the U.S. economy is very important, not just to us who live here, but to the rest of the world, because the rest of the world needs to know that the United States is stable and going to be here when they need us. And if we're struggling with a terrible recession of our own, that's not confidence enhancing in the geostrategic realm. But monetary and fiscal policy are great tools to have, but they're not going to be the things that make us grow in the long run.
Yeah, and I think this is sometimes where Keynes gets a bad name because, you know, he was a proponent of fiscal stimulus and when you're in a recessionary period to stimulate demand. But the other aspect of smoothing, when the economy is prosperous and getting overheated, you know, governments have a tough time then increasing taxes or cutting back on spending when things are looking rosy. And now I would say the Federal Reserve and managing our monetary policy maybe does a better job of that. And you could look back to the stagflation era and Volcker cutting interest rates. And, you know, that was effective probably use of monetary policy, even though it wasn't a growth period. But smoothing out the prosperous time seems to be problematic.
Yeah, it's occurred to me for a long time that Maynard Keynes was a brilliant man, a brilliant economist, and the whole idea of Keynesian stimulus has struck me as the most dangerous correct idea in the world. And it's not dangerous for any economic reasons, it's dangerous for political reasons.
Right.
That, I mean, the correct use of Keynes' insight is that you should stimulate in the weak periods and get your debt back under control when the economy is in a strong position. Well, politicians being who they are, they're always anxious to do the first and very reluctant to rein it in during the good times.
Right.
And to its credit, the Federal Reserve, I share your view that the Federal Reserve seems to have been more responsible in at least recent years in this regard. But it's not an accident that the Federal Reserve is politically independent.
Right.
Nobody votes for the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board.
Yeah. I remember reading the book Maestro about Greenspan and how he's managed to tame the economy's economic cycles. And my concern is, you know, what happens today if we have a new recession? And now growth seems to be doing well. Now we just had this great big tax cut. What happens, though, if we have another recession?
There will be another recession. I mean, there always is, and we don't know when it's going to come. They're notoriously hard to forecast. The joke is that the really good forecasters have forecast 12 of the last 8 recessions.
Right.
And but one will come. And if it comes soon, say next year, it's going to be tough. Because the stabilization tools that are available to us generally, typically, are very much weakened at the moment. What the monetary policy response to a new recession is generally to cut interest rates. But interest rates are still very, very low. They're moving up.
They're creeping up, right.
Creeping up, but there's not room to cut them very much anymore. So if we can hold on for a few more years until interest rates have climbed back up to more normal levels, then our stock of ammunition will be replenished.
Right.
Similarly, on the fiscal side, with the very large government debts we have today, the idea of another big fiscal stimulus like we had in 2009 or like we just got in the last few months seems to me to be off the table. Actually, I rather hope it's off the table.
Right.
We're not going to be able to use fiscal policy. So we're in a bit of a delicate situation right now. We'll come out of it. We'll get through it. But a recession that came soon could be problematic.
Yeah, so the other thing I wanted to talk about from getting back to the national security strategy is this goal that is set out in there to create wealth for Americans and our allies. I guess my question to you is, What do we mean by creating wealth, and how are we doing in the United States creating wealth, especially here?
Yeah, I think it's at very best a mixed picture for creating wealth in the United States. First of all, let's go back and make sure let's be clear why we care. I mean, of course, we all would prefer to be wealthy rather than less wealthy.
I would prefer to be wealthy, yes.
But it has geostrategic implications. I mean, a wealthy country is more likely to be a confident country. It'll be a country that is able and willing to absorb the inevitable costs of world leadership. It's a country that is resilient to the shocks that openness brings. I mean, if we're open to the world economy, that means from time to time, events in other parts of the world are going to affect us. If we're good and wealthy and have high incomes and we're confident in that, when these knocks come, we'll say, fine, right. Okay. I wish that hadn't happened, but no big deal. We'll weather it. Now, on average, we're doing a wonderful job at creating wealth in the United States and income. The value of the housing stock is rising again. The stock market is rising again. Unemployment is falling now down to levels we haven't seen in a couple of decades. Wages are just beginning to rise. Right. They haven't yet really recovered. But here's where the business about creating wealth on average comes in. That is not very well spread out through the U.S. economy today. And by the way, this is not just the U.S. The same is happening to differing degrees in other advanced countries. And important parts of our population and the population of other advanced countries are being left behind.
Right.
That's problematic from a human point of view, but it's also problematic from a geostrategic point of view. This is not the only cause of division within the United States, but it is an important cause of
right.
division within the United States. Whenever anybody asks for more defense spending, say, there is also somebody with a very strong argument saying, no, you've got to give me more.
For social programs.
Yeah, you've got to give me more for social programs and helping the poor and so on. And whenever there's a tax cut to make U.S. industry and U.S. companies more efficient, there is also somebody saying, no, you've got to give me something to help the middle class or the lower paid workers, whether that's good for long-term efficiency or not.
Right.
And I guess the worst of all possible worlds is when these, which is the one we perhaps have today, where these opposing forces stymie each other and we get paralysis.
Yeah, and I think that links into our discussion of debt in the last segment, because when countries finally get to that realization we're in trouble and they try to impose fiscal austerity measures, it tends to hurt the poor more than it hurts those people who are well-to-do or have wealth. And we see this in developing countries, but also in developed countries, because when you cut fiscal programs, a lot of times it's social programs, the entitlements, and the people most dependent on those are the people who have the least wealth and least resiliency, as you mentioned.
It doesn't have to be that way, of course, but it has worked out that way. I think it's important, though, to also bear in mind what the real underlying source of the growing inequality, in at least in the advanced world, is these days. And it's not because we have evil plutocrats who try to steal everything. I mean, sure, there are some bad actors out there, but that's not the real reason. The real reason is something much less personal, and it is that we seem to be today in an era where technological change strongly favors the well-educated.
Highly skilled.
Highly skilled.
Right.
Now, it hasn't always been that way. To pick an extreme example, back in the Industrial Revolution that started in the 19th century, the rise of factories suddenly provided a place for rather low-skilled workers, people who were just coming off the farm,
right.
to go into a factory and be very productive. Now, they had miserable working conditions, and they had to live in terrible slums, but they were productive, and their wages showed it.
Right.
In that era, technological change really helped the less skilled. But today, it's not. Today, it's helping those who have really, in some sense, already made it because their parents could afford a really first-class education, and they've had experience in these kinds of jobs. It's a particularly nasty kind of inequality we face today, because you can't correct it easily. I mean, you can't change the forces of innovation,
right?
Or at least we don't know how to. And we want to be, you don't want to really mess with that because that's our future as well. So it's a very pernicious and socially difficult kind of inequality we have today.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. But unfortunately, our time is up for this segment. Thank you again, Dr. New, and I look forward to our last episode.
Thanks.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.